This is the Law and the Future of War podcast, brought to you from the University of Queensland Law School. Through conversation with experts in technology, law, and military affairs, this series explores how international law regulates new military technologies.
Thank you for joining us today, listeners. My name is Eve Massingham, and I am a Senior Research Fellow in the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland. Today, we are going to be talking about military technology. In particular, what are the key areas of current investment, how the game is changing, and what the future might look like. I'm joined today by Professor Jason Schultz, Chief Executive Officer of the Trusted Autonomous Systems Defence Cooperative Research Centre, and Associate Professor Simon Ng, Chief Engineer at the Centre. Both of them have extensive qualifications and have had long careers as engineers in defence, science and technology. They are incredibly well placed to discuss with us their perspectives on investment in military technology today and into the future, as well as the role of Australia and of their organisation in this space. Welcome to the show, Jason and Simon.
Hi, Eve. Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Eve. Yes, also a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation.
I might turn to you first, Jason. I'm interested in what you think are the particularly significant investments in military technologies over recent years. You've seen quite a lot of technological change in the military space. And what are some of those that are particularly attracting your attention today?
There are quite a range of technologies that have been kind of coming together to make a change or transformation in military systems in this area. So miniaturisation, a lot of commercial technologies that we're seeing in computer processing, data storage, sensor technologies, materials. So there's really quite a huge range of things which all coming together kind of lead, I think, to some inevitable conclusions about where this technology will take us into the future. More specifically, I guess, artificial intelligence is a key one for us, robotics, as these technologies are used, and the coordination of those systems into the future.
Jason, you mentioned commercial technologies and a lot of linkages with commercial technology. Has this always been the case in the military technology space?
A number of countries have made some very large investments in technologies in the past. And, of course, military drove some of those. Even our internet today, of course, was a DARPA initiative and invention, so conceptually pushed more from the military space. Now, that's obviously shifted today. And really, the military still is involved in looking at those concepts of how to bring it together, but relying very much on the commercial drivers.
So what do you think have been the biggest sort of technological advancements that you see changing the game? You've obviously mentioned a lot of different advancements that have taken place in recent years, but the game is clearly changing. Perhaps I could bring you in, Simon, here, and ask you what you think are those advancements that are changing the game.
Sure, no problems, Eve. So I have this this kind of view of what I call the three C's, and I think Jason's mentioned these largely, but I think about these three C's as kind of the core things that are changing the way we think about war, but also changing the nature of conflict and how we respond to it. The first one is computing, and I include in that the concepts of data science. We've learnt a lot from the rich fundamentals of neuroscience and cognitive science, and that has led to analogs in the computer space, which is giving us the capacity to develop machines that can perceive the world in new and interesting ways, and importantly, in much richer ways. So that's changing our relationship with machines and changing the capability of what machines can do. But also in that computing space, we're able to extract and analyze data in ways that we haven't been able to before. We have a much broader range of sensing capabilities, but also a much broader range of analytical capabilities to make sense of that information that we collect. So that's the first C. The second C I call connectivity, or is connectivity. We think about that in terms of the internet, and there's no doubt that the internet has transformed and enabled some of what we've seen in terms of our ability to exploit data. But it's also democratizing communication. And seeing, for example, the re-emergence of citizen soldiers, the kind of cyber levy en masse is an interesting idea. And some of the listeners may be aware that a hacker collective called Anonymous took on Islamic State. That's just another example of how technology, the connectivity technology, is changing the way that the military operates, but also who is undertaking military action. And finally, Jason touched on this, commodification. Technology is becoming ubiquitous. It's becoming cheaper, and that's because the civilian technology development ecosystem is really dominating technology development. We've seen that in mobile phones, in drones, and even more so in the space of AI. An interesting fact, I think, is that private sector investment in AI in the last 5 years has outstripped government investment in AI in total. So they're the three core areas of technology, I think, that are fundamentally changing warfare.
Thanks, Simon. That's really interesting and raises a whole range of questions. The first one I wanted to turn to was this idea that you talked about with machine perception, and machine perception being able to, I think, use the word richer to enhance the technology and what we can do with it in richer ways. I know that there is also the counter argument to that, of course, and concerns about what machine perception might result in for society. Can I ask you for your thoughts on how we might balance those benefits with those negatives?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Richer machine perception will introduce challenges for us. But there have always been challenges in terms of exercising due control in conflict, whether it's over machines or over people. We have legal frameworks, we have social expectations, social norms that are important mechanisms for us to regulate action in war. Giving machines the capacity to perceive the world doesn't necessarily remove the importance of, well, doesn't in fact at all remove the importance of those mechanisms. And indeed, one of the things that I think machine perception lends us is perhaps the capacity to reinforce those mechanisms in much more objective ways than we have in the past. We're all aware of some of the tragic events that happen in war due to poor human judgment, mistakes, a mistaken identity, for example. One of the things that I think will be significant in terms of machine perception is its ability to provide, if you like, a checkpoint for some of the tasks we assign to systems, an ability to look at a scene and to determine whether, in fact, there might be an infringement of the laws of armed conflict or the rules of engagement, and using that information to inform a decision maker who can then intervene, or indeed, at some point, introducing this concept of min-AI into the system, allowing the system itself to abort an action if it becomes aware of something in the world that is going to result in humanitarian disaster or a an infringement on the rules of engagement or the laws of armed conflict. So it does introduce complications, but it also gives us an opportunity to actually manage that in quite different ways.
Thank you, Simon. Jason, Simon has mentioned this idea of due control and talked a little bit about human focus. I know from earlier discussions that in a lot of the work that you have done in your career, you've focused on these ideas of command and control. Could you give us a little bit of an idea about how you see machines interacting with these sort of traditionally very human-focused concepts in the law of armed conflict?
Indeed. I've worked for quite a few years in the command and control area, which for the military is that decision-making component. And what we have here with this machine perception that Simon's introduced and the like is some of those cognitive functions and decision functions to be made in the machine, or having a machine support a human's decision in that process. So this new mix of in the decision-making process is what is key here. And I've worked with a colleague, Dale Lambert, who and we developed a concept quite some years ago called ubiquitous command and control, which is about having a similar and a significant command and control capability in every platform, every system. So it's kind of that democratization, which was mentioned, of devolving decision making. It's certainly not exclusive of people at all. It recognises the strengths and weaknesses of humans and of machines. And the concept here of integration of decision-making is one that puts the strengths of one to offset the weaknesses of another. And in doing this as well, it allows for a kind of a loose coupling between systems. So a way I like to think about this is kind of like a contract between people and machines, and between machines and other machines. Now, typically, command and control has been like a contract, an agreement process, if you like, between people. And I think if we can naturally find a way to extend that to binding machines to contracts from people, effectively borrowing from common law, I think that is an incredibly powerful way to deal not only with the cognitive load, so we should in the future no longer just pilot and drive these machines, because that's very intensive and doesn't scale. We should give them our intent constraints, have the machine come back to us with options and possibilities of what it could do. We reach an agreement with it, so accept or reject its offer and bind that to behaviour. So in Australia, there's a concept of a thing called mission command and among allied nations, and it really would rest in that construct, I think.
Thank you. When Simon was going through the three C's for us, he mentioned this idea of connectivity and the changing players in this space. And it made me think that we had perhaps specifically been thinking to date about the offensive use of this technology. And I think that the counter technologies component is really significant. If there are a whole new range of players in the game, including many who are non-state actors, there seems that it will be even more challenging and even more important that militaries focus in the counter technology space. It would be great to hear from both of you. Perhaps we'll go to you first, Jason, and then Simon, on your thoughts of how we use these technologies that we've been talking about in a way that is effective and can't be eliminated by the enemy.
Good question. So I guess what I could reflect on first is some of the approaches that we see emerging and around the world at the moment. And I liken these to what kind of almost like an industrial age approach to countermeasures. So things like energy, directed energy weapons, electromagnetic pulse, all sorts of rather exquisite countermeasures, which are complex, pretty difficult to deploy and large. I ultimately think that where this will need to go is a kind of a game, as it usually is the case of measures and countermeasures in the military, where like is put up against like. So if the threat are things like small drones carrying explosives and things like that as an example of a threat, and perhaps from multiple vehicles, then I think we'll be countering that with multiple small vehicles at the same time to counter the threat. And is it ever always entirely effective? No, it's always a game. It's a balance in a game theoretic sense. So that it becomes a more, rather than a big leap ahead, now it becomes incremental changes to try and maintain protection. But I think at the moment we're certainly Western nations and the like have created technologies that leave them quite exposed.
Simon, did you want to jump in with any thoughts on that point?
Yeah, certainly will. I think it's a really hard question to answer. I don't think there is a really good answer at the moment. The consequences of connectivity are sort of twofold. So in one sense, some of the traditional boundaries for the flow of information, for communication, have fundamentally changed, which means our associations are becoming very distributed. Are we at the kind of end of Hobbes's social contract? I don't know. But we certainly are finding under this sort of connectivist regime that people's allegiances, their ideas, don't come from the traditional sources in the same way. But conversely, we're seeing governments reach down and begin to regulate these systems to try and get us past that postmodernist truth version of reality that we seem to get through the internet. Now, Jason mentioned something really important earlier when he was talking about ubiquitous command and control, and that was the idea of contracts. And underlying contracts, I think, has to be a mechanism to ensure that we understand the provenance of information, we understand the provenance of communication that comes through this sort of connected world. And while I'm not suggesting that this is a solution to all the problems that's posed by your question, I think that there's something significant in the idea of smart contracts and maybe in blockchain technology that will give us some degree of integrity when it comes to how we treat information, but also how we treat actors in this kind of integrated space that we're working in. It's not in no sense am I suggesting that's the whole solution to how we deal with the threats that this sort of connectivity creates, but it may be a solution. And in fact, we've talked about that as, for example, a mechanism for overcoming spoofing in the battle space. If you can provide some sort of validation of where information comes from that exploits the distributed nature of information, then perhaps you can overcome the kind of exploitations that are currently used in networks, whether it's cyber attack or spoofing attack using radio frequency spectrum. But I certainly think, as a general question, there's a lot of work to be done here to really understand how best we counter the threats that the connectivity we're seeing is introducing.
Simon, you mentioned blockchain and certainly in the answers to date, both yourself and Jason have mentioned a number of technologies which currently exist. Perhaps there is more to come with these technologies. But there is always the sort of what does the future question look like? And I'd be interested in your perceptions on what might be in particular military domains, some of the technological developments that the community should be keeping an eye out for. Jason, I understand you've recently been commended for your service to Navy in particular in the robotics and autonomous systems area. So perhaps we'll move to you to give us a naval answer in that space and give Simon a second to think about the other military domains as to where he sees they are going in the future.
Look, sure. Thank you. If I was to contextualise this at a slightly abstract level, then I'll drill down, okay? A lot of when we think about Navy, we think about ships and shipbuilding, especially in Australia, and it's critically important to have numbers when it comes to times of conflict in terms of platforms and systems. But we're largely invested in complex, large and few platforms. And why is that? It's because of the threats in the battle space that have come for Navy and others that have meant that we have to give these platforms more exquisite defensive measures to keep the people alive that operate and make decisions on those systems. And because they are complex, large and few, They're few because they're so expensive, right? And if they're really expensive, then we can only afford to have a small number. And if that's the case, we also can't afford to lose them. So the response to this perhaps is robotic systems that are the antithesis in a sense of that, but still needs to work with it. So rather than complex, large and few, we think about smart, small and many. And that produces its own problems because for Navy, we might have to work over very, very long ranges and distances and project power or defence over long ranges. And small things have a small size, weight and power limitations. So we need other vehicles and vessels to be able to take them there and deploy them and nearer to where they'll be used. But it has a whole lot of advantages because if manned vessels like our surface ships and the like can be detected, tracked and potentially attacked at long ranges, then we're going to rely more and more on stealthy, small systems. That's one of the reasons why our submarines, our manned submarines, I'll add, are still a crucial capability for the country. These things all together need to be part of that solution where we can recreate the mass that we've lost. And for Navy, that's particularly the case. Very, very small technologies that can measure to the bottom of the oceans and autonomous sensor systems underwater are examples of some of the technologies that could potentially be used over quite wide areas. So there are many, many transformational things available coming for Navy.
And Simon, no doubt this idea of smart, small and many makes sense out of the water as well. But are there any particular technologies in the land, air or space domain that you think we should be keeping an eye out on?
Let me maybe preface my response by first saying that I think the nature of war, which is a very human activity, is probably not going to change dramatically over the next 15 years. The technology with which we wage it and perhaps how we wage it will change. But, you know, what we're not doing here, or certainly what I'm not doing, is attempting to suggest that we are going to somehow have a very sanitized battlefield. I don't think that's the case, and certainly not in the next 15 years. But I think Jason's really covered off a lot of what I would say anyway, but I'll try and add to it. In particular, I think we are moving towards the small, the smart and the many. But along with that, we're moving towards a set of capabilities which are lower cost and which are attritable. They don't replace these exquisite platforms that we're investing in and rightly investing in, but they provide a complementary capability to those platforms. They give us a freedom of manoeuvre, a force multiplication, an ability to operate in environments and domains where we haven't operated before, and an ability to operate in ways in which we're reducing risk to the men and women that make up our defence forces. So I think that certainly is a change that will permeate across the domains. Robotics, automation and AI are central to that, but so are miniaturization and some of the advanced manufacturing techniques that are becoming more and more common, both in the military but also in the civilian sector. And by advanced manufacturing, I don't just mean 3D printing, I mean advanced digital design methods, agile digital design methods. And finally, I think simulation is playing an increasingly important role in helping us to be prepared to fight in future conflicts, helping us to explore the implications of technology change, both technology change we have, but also technology change that our adversary has. And that will play out across those domains. But increasingly, I think the transformations are actually happening perpendicular to the domains. I think we're seeing the potential for these technologies specifically to transform the way we do logistics. The US Marine Corps, for example, is already deploying 3D printing machines to be able to manufacture drones and drone parts in the field. When you couple that with new simulation tools that might allow us, for example, to very rapidly receive feedback from an operation and do evolutionary design of a new technology, you know, say a new aircraft or a new ground system, and then push that forward as a digital model to allow manufacturing in the field. That's going to transform logistics. We're also seeing a transformation in command and control across the domains. And in fact, this ubiquitous command and control is deliberately breaking down the notion of domains by having the small, the smart, and the many, and a ubiquitous command and control structure. We're actually allowing machines between domains to cooperate, to dynamically form teams, to dynamically cooperate and compose solutions to problems that need to be met in the context of a commander's intent. And finally, as I implied before, I think also the use of computing power, the use of autonomy combined with simulation is going to revolutionize the way we do training. And again, that will cut across the domains. We need the layman's interpretation of the 10,000 hour to expert benchmark is a salient one. We don't build that sort of experience in our military commanders because, fortunately, we don't involve them in that sort of length of conflict. So how do we build that experience? And I think we can do that in the simulation space if we make really efficient use of artificial intelligence, really efficient use of simulation tools, and that will transform then how we fight in the maritime domain, the air domain, the land domain, and indeed the space domain.
So many of these technologies that you've clearly mentioned and the different uses, obviously not just warfighting, but for activities such as logistics, are clearly of interest to Australia and the Australian Defence Force. We have seen in recent white papers a focus on this. And of course, just last week, we saw the release of the 2040 concept note on robotics and autonomous systems by the Defence Force. So there's clearly an interest from Australia in it. And the Trusted Autonomous Systems Defence Cooperative Research Centre is clearly a part of that. Jason, could I ask you to give us a little bit of a background about your centre and the different projects that you are supporting through your work?
Sure. Our centre was formed in 2018 but announced in 2017 by then Minister Pine. And it's drawing from the Next Generation Technologies Fund, around about $50 million from the Commonwealth Government to develop game-changing technologies in trusted autonomous systems. So that was the genesis for it. It was set up based on a Cooperative Research Centre or CRC model, but taking some more specific strengths of that program and adding some things that would suit defence, like defence use rights and sovereign use rights over technologies as we develop intellectual property as part of the setup, and somewhat independently of defence. So we still have defence very strongly engaged. Our chair is appointed by the Minister for Defence and so on. We have a degree of independence because we need to be able to very quickly bring in these commercial technologies and make calls on potentially winning and game-changing things and making those calls quite quickly. So the term of the centre is currently limited to 7 years, so we've got a few years left. And we take on projects. We currently have a portfolio around about 13 projects at the moment and more in the pipeline. Each project centres around some intellectual property that's going to be created. It's guided by defence needs at a very high level of a needs statement. However, they're all industry-led so that a commercial, and I mean defence commercial outcome, is something that can be pulled through by a company. And underpinning all of that, academic input from Australian universities and absolutely critical, our Defence Science and Technology Group in Australia providing some of that really niche research that will help make a big difference. So we kind of bring all of that together and package them up into projects which are 1 to 5 years in duration, get to a stage of a technology demonstrator, which if there is then a defence project that could pick it up and take it through to a higher technology readiness level and transition it into operations. That's what we're here for.
Great, thank you. Well, I think we might close then, but I wanted to ask you both for some kind of further reading recommendations. I have certainly enjoyed and found very interesting Paul Charest's Army of None, one of those books back in the pre-COVID days that you could sort of buy at an airport and read rather than an academic text. Could you leave us with a few thoughts about if we are interested in this space a bit more, what would you recommend us delving into? Perhaps to you first, Simon.
Sure. I guess these are all reads for the informed layman, I suppose, is how I'd paraphrase them. So David Kilcullen is one of the foremost military thinkers today. He wrote a book called Out of the Mountains. It's a very, very compelling study of where we are likely to fight. And I think where we fight determines to a large extent how we must fight and what role technology has to play in that. So it's certainly well worth a look. The idea of technology as an instigator of military revolutions has been around for quite a while now, but there's an excellent text by Knox and Murray called The Dynamics of Military Revolutions. And that is probably a bit hard to get, but very well researched and really explains the relationship between social revolutions and military revolutions and what role technology has to play in that. And the third one I'd probably recommend is by Stephen Biddle. It's called Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. Biddle draws a range of conclusions, but perhaps the conclusion that I found most compelling was that technology overmatch isn't a good predictor of who wins wars, because wars are socio-political things and not technical things. So they're the three that I'd probably put at the top of my list as a good introduction. The only other one I'd add is Grossman's book On Killing. Grossman is was an army psychologist, and in On Killing he talks very much about the role that technology plays in providing moral, physical, emotional distance between the person undertaking the act of killing and the person that they are undertaking that act against. So they'd be my recommendations as good reads.
Thanks, Simon. Jason, I think you've got the harder task to go second there, but over to you.
Simon's made for quite a good reading list there already. So perhaps one, I think, to back up some of the thinking I mentioned about this smart, small and many, there's a gentleman named Martin Libicki. I'm just trying to recall the name of the book. It's something to the effect of Warfare in an Age of Free Silicon. It's old. Okay, I think it's 1998. However, it's one of those things that philosophy often leads the technology and the revolutions by decades, right? So Martin Libicki's treatise in there is quite good, which I'd recommend. I think just to put a bit of a twist at this at the end, rather than a read, something I would propose people might want to look at is, I'm not sure if it's still available as a $1.49 download, which it has been up until quite recently, is an app called Philosopher AI. Philosopher AI, you can pose some simple questions to, and it will provide quite a detailed thinking piece, like almost slightly conversational. Behind that is an AI called GPT-3. GPT-3 is absolutely astounding. So what I'd recommend for people is if they've got some thoughts or ideas about this and they want to consider the legal aspects of some of these technologies or whatever, ask GPT-3, ask the AI for its opinion. And Philosopher AI is one way potentially into that.
Well, it sounds like our listeners have a little bit of homework coming from that. I'd like to thank you, Jason and Simon, very much for your time today. and for sharing those reflections of some very interesting technologies and some different ways that we might be doing things into the future. Thank you.
Pleasure, Eve. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast was made by the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland Law School. A full list of episodes and links to additional material, as well as our contact details, are available on our website. Just search for Law and the Future of War. This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.